Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba tal-Bank of Valletta. Campus FM jippreżenta Mhux kelma bejn tnejn, l-intervista tal-Bank of Valletta. Jippreżentaw il-program Father Joe Borch u l-Professur Joe Pirotta.
Għadda ġobor xin kien ma' l-ħabib tijaj, il-professor ġobor otta, nistednu kom għal program jħol, fil-sensi la' mux kelma bejtni l-intervista tal-BOV. Il-lum, il-mistident għanna, u l-ambasġatur Amerikan, il-professor Douglas Kimmick, fil-fat, l-uniku wieħed, fil-sensi la' li kien anki fil-sensi la' li għaddiet. Imma mill-intervista li kien l-ħadarba kien hemm ħafna jisom punti ta' interess u ħadejna uħud minnhom daqsxejn indendlin fl-arja. Allura għadna li ma tkunx idea ħażina nerġgħu nistiednu għal darba oħra l-ambaxxatur Amerikan. I welcome you, Mr. Ambassador.
Good morning, Father. Professor, nice to be with you both.
Quite naturally, the United States is a big country, so it's a complex country. In a certain sense, it's a country of extremes, because you will find all sorts of ideas in the melting pot. Also, it has overseas people build around it the kind of stereotype that, at least in Malta, if something is out of this world or very strange, we'll say Americanata. But there is something about American society, and I think about the ethos of the American way of living, which is freedom. And we would like to explore with you today, among other things which can come up in the wash, the concept, the American concept of freedom. And when does freedom stop being real freedom? Because it's it will be suppressing minorities. So how is the balance how is the balance held, and in a country where you have so many different ideas, how do you balance the freedom of one group with the freedom of another group, which is totally difficult or radically different? So let me start with an example, and then we'll go into the discussion. Recently there was that incident when a pastor of an almost non-existent group in some remote part of the United States said that he was going to burn the Quran. And all of a sudden, it became an international issue. And many people overseas could not understand why someone would have told him, no, you will not do it. Because he has the freedom to do it. But should he have the freedom to get all the United States and in trouble and create an international crisis? Is that freedom?
It's a form of freedom, and it's extreme. The issue you raise is one of freedom of expression versus responsibility of expression, and the question would then become, do you trust the government to be the monitor of what is responsible, or do you have to rely, and should you rely, on the individual person in the media, for example, to not find this obscure person, as you referred to him, a small pastor in Florida who had a flock of some 40 people who clearly was at the margins of society. Should you treat his pronouncements the same way you would treat the pronouncements of the Holy Father, who speaks to a congregation of millions and a universal church? Should you treat his pronouncements the same as you would treat the Anglican canon, you know, the who speaks to large groups and so forth? I think the answer most people on the street would give, and it would be one that I would have some affinity for, is that you would hope the media would have recognized the difference and qualitatively would have exercised restraint. Now, where does restraint come from? Obviously, restraint in a legal system can come from a penalty, where you would have a law that would say if you cross that line, you would suffer a penalty. But the real difficulty there is one of definition. And if you enact things into law, you're allowing the government to be a censor of sorts. And when you allow the government to be a censor, you run the risk that it will not just censor speech that is wrongly elevated to great status, but it'll start censoring speech that criticizes itself as to what is, and thereby suppress speech that's necessary for the democratic principle. You know, all this issue, let me separate for a moment just from the example you gave, Father, to ask something more fundamental about the American constitutional system. You know, we have recited in our Constitution that no person shall be denied life, liberty, or property. And we have recited in our Declaration of Independence that no person should be, that we hold the truth that all men and women are entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. One has to, in examining the question of freedom, ask the question, is it government's purpose to make man moral, or is it the purpose of others in society to have the freedom to operate on that moral question? I think the founders of our republic depended upon non-governmental entities to make man moral, to address man's formation of conscience, and did not depend upon the government with the exercise of power or penalty to be about that business. And so for the most part, the exercise of freedom in the United States in its original design was an exercise of freedom that would be monitored by family, would be monitored by church. Indeed, you know, one sees at the time of the founding of the Republic that it would have been entirely possible for the states to have established churches. Right? Because there's nothing in the Constitution which would preclude the individual states from having established churches, and some of them did. And so, to that degree, one sees a sense of the founders having an expectation that freedom would be limited by entities and sources outside of government, and therefore without running the risk of government suppression of ideas or the use of power to wrongly preserve position.
But today, in this, okay, so we are saying that there should be this kind of balance in society, government, the media, the churches, the family, etc., balancing each other out. But I refer you to what Ben Bagdignan wrote. Ben Bagdignan has a series of books called Media Monopolies, and from time to time he publishes his books, gauging whether the media in the United States are becoming more pluralistic or there is more monopoly, in the sense that you would have fewer and fewer corporations controlling more and more. And he speaks about the private Ministry of Information. In the United States, you don't have a Ministry for Information. And he says that the media are a private Ministry of Information and that their agenda is dominated by the people who have money. So, in this case, isn't it a case where then that freedom will be dominated or will be the property, so to speak, of people who have money? So it's not real freedom for the people because the media feed you what they want to feed you, and the media tell you what they want to tell you, and we depend on what they tell us. So our freedom is being limited, not expanded by the media, perhaps.
You know, I think that was a concern that would have had a great deal of resonance for me in the 1980s, but I'm not sure that in 2010 I would concur, Father, for this reason, and that is as much as the established media, the television stations, radio stations, and newspapers are to some degree owned by the factors of wealth. And I would suspect that in many cases that's true. One just merely has to look at the fact that Rupert Murdoch owns the Wall Street Journal, and there you can find similar examples of investment on all sides of the political spectrum. There's just so much information that is available from alternative sources now. I doubt that wealth can quite have that direct line effect that it once had when the media was concentrated on a few TV stations and a few radio stations. I mean, now you can create a blog, even on the Times of Malta, for example.
I know one who has one. Yes.
Suddenly have great readership and with very little capital investment in terms of you don't have to have printing presses and distribution networks. You've got a ready-made distribution network. So I think it's much harder for the factors of wealth to dominate as they did only a handful of years ago. That's not to say wealth doesn't have, in the short term, distorting effects. For example, President Obama was much concerned by a Supreme Court opinion that allowed corporations to use their treasury funds, as it were, the funds they had on hand, the wealth that they had accumulated in their reserves, in an unlimited way to support candidates, even though the Congress of the United States had placed limits on the amount individuals could give, and indeed had placed limits on the amount that corporations could give. But the Supreme Court decided that limiting the amount of money spent on politics was the same as limiting speech. I question that premise. I know the president does as well. I don't think money is speech. For the very reason we talked about before, people with relatively little money can create their own blog, their own website. They can indeed start to be heard among a range of people that they couldn't in the past. And therefore, I wouldn't worry too much about the concentration of ownership. But I do worry about the short-term effects in an election, where suddenly a large amount of funds can be utilized to distort the short-term conversation. It takes a while for the truth to sift its way through, for the marketplace of ideas to have its effect, and there can be distortions by vast wealth of corporations. And I think the Congress of the United States tried to address those distortions not by limiting what you could spend the money on in a content restriction, but by the amount that could be spent. Unfortunately, the current Supreme Court doesn't agree with Congress on that.
The American Constitution, if I'm correct, and of course correct me if I'm not, was drafted, I think, on at least in one concept, one of the concepts on which it was drafted, was that there should be small government. And I think one of the inbuilt ideas of freedom, individual freedom, was part of this, and it was also historically part of it because the great attraction for European migrants to the United States was that it offered this freedom. There was no one to tell you which church to belong to. There was no one to tell you what particular political line you had to follow and the forces and so on. So I think it's easy to understand these concepts besides the philosophy involved. Mm-hmm. But the world has changed a lot. And the idea of freedom in certain areas, we're talking about freedom of speech here, but there are other areas which are surprising to non-Americans. For example, one of the great debates in America for some time has been the freedom to carry arms. And people outside the United States especially, who are not used to that kind of concept, question whether it is freedom or whether it is a license to kill. How do Americans usually, now I don't want to use Americans actually because there's no, I don't agree with stereotypes. There isn't a typical American. But public opinion in general, how does it view this? Is it moving in the direction of lessening that freedom? Or would you say that it is still holding to the old precepts, let's put that way?
Well, it's a fascinating question. I think the man on the street in the United States would see the right to bear arms generally favorably in two respects. One, the right to own a hunting rifle to undertake, hunting exercises as sport would be regularly defended by the man on the street. As to the ownership of handguns, one would, I think, find a fair amount of sentiment in favor of the ownership of handguns as a political matter for the right of self-defense. That's where the common discussion would go. Beyond that, there would be considerable concern about the number of suicides that occur in the United States because of the availability of handgun weapons and the number of property crimes that become matters of life and death because the property crime is facilitated by the availability of those mm-hmm. weapons. So that's the politics of the matter. People defending hunting, the right to self-defense, mm-hmm. but at the same time counterbalanced by a concern that is borne out by the statistics that there's a much higher rate of suicide, much higher rate of handgun death in the United States than there are in other developed countries. And how does the politics line up with the Constitution? The Constitution has an amendment, the Second Amendment, that says the right of the militia is important. By virtue of the fact that it is the right to keep and bear arms is preserved. So you have two propositions in that Second Amendment. One that says the right of militia is important to the maintenance of a free state. The right to keep and bear arms shall be preserved. When that language, for the most part, was uninterpreted by the Supreme Court or other courts for most of the history of the country until recently. When it was interpreted, the original interpretation linked the right to have a gun to the existence of a militia. The existence of the militia, which was the right of the people to come together to defend themselves against tyranny, was thought necessary for the states to protect themselves against the overarching power of the federal government. So you had a question of freedom there, that the reason gun accessibility was allowed under the original Constitution was to protect the states from a federal government getting too large. Now comes the 21st century, and the Supreme Court, again, in my judgment, unwisely separates the concept of militia from the right of gun ownership, says it's not dependent upon the right of militia. That was just one of its purposes. But instead, it could, be a right that could be exercised for these other purposes, namely self-defense. And now we have a constitutional claim that applies nationwide that previously was very limited in scope but now has become much wider and subject to some still unsettled interpretation. My own preference, given the large number of deaths that occur in terms of property crime and in terms of at one's own hand in the concept of suicide, would be to invite Congress and the states to legislate to restrict gun ownership very broadly outside of the very narrow range of hunting purposes And then we'd be talking about a different kind of weapon. But that's a political choice on my part. The Constitution, it seems to me, does not guarantee mm-hmm. what the Supreme Court has found it to guarantee in terms of an expansive right. But one of the things you have to live with in the United States is that you have judges who have the final say. As one of the judges said, we're not final necessarily because we're right. We're right because we're final. When they make something a pronouncement of the Constitution, then the political process is stopped, because mm-hmm. once something is declared to be a right, you can't really undo that without amending the Constitution, which is very difficult in terms of the process outlined in the structure of it.
Kien fakru li semijatan, għet nisimaw il-program muxkelmu bejtnej l-intervista tal-Biovi, kien fader ġo borx finkjom għal-professur ġo, pero għet nitkelmu ma l-ambasġatur Amerikan, il-professur Douglas Kemmick. Kunu maħna wara din il-pawsa.
Tkun xi tkun it-triq li tażel matul ħajtek, aħna nistgħu ngħinuk tfassal pjan finanzjarju li jaqdi l-ħtiġijiet tiegħek. Kellimna issa, Bank of Valletta, impenn lejn is-suċċess tiegħek. Il-Bank of Valletta huwa l-liċenzjat sabiex jipprovdi servizzi ta' investiment mill-MFSA.
Lura għall-programm qed nitkellmu l-professur Douglas, kemmek l-ambasġatur Amerikan. Freedom is a fantastic thing. Beautiful. Undoubtedly one of the best characteristics that a society can have. But when you had the discussion in the United States about the health reform, one of the things that I could not understand when I was reading about it, and perhaps I was not understanding it, was the opposition that there was from many quarters about things which here in Europe, or in Malta at least, we hold them as a given. And some were also bringing in this idea that we should be free from the interference of government. When, at least as we see it from this side of the world, is that without such a system of health, which guarantees the best kind of health to the people who cannot pay, you do not really have freedom, because you only have possibilities for the people who have money, the possibility to die in misery for the people who don't have money. So how is it that there are some people there are many people in the United States who are attacking the concept of the reform using this angle of freedom from government?
Well, again, going back to the language of the Constitution, I think, Father, there's much soundness to the criticism you've impliedly just made, and that is that in our founding document, the Declaration of Independence, again, it's the order is life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. So life precedes liberty and the pursuit of happiness, and it has to. If your life is not secured, and then you don't have the opportunity to exercise freedom or liberty or the opportunity to pursue happiness as you would define it. So too in the Constitution, no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process. Again, the order is life first. And so there's a strong argument to be made that unless one has a government that is securing within the realm of the possible, as medical science would allow it to exist at any given time, securing the life of all of its citizens, that the government is not well ordered. It has things backwards. It has made that which is subordinate or secondary primary. Now, in the United States, this has always been recognized in matters of defense. You know, it is often said by presidents that the first who are confronting or contemplating the use of military power, that the first order of business for a government is to safeguard its citizens and their lives from external harms or attack. Not much quibble with that. But what doesn't seem to be equally recognized is that life is sustained not just against a physical force, an external force that would challenge it with weapons, but life is subject to challenge by disease and illness and bad nutritional habits. And unless you've ordered the government in a way that addresses those matters, you've got things topsy-turvy, you've got things inverted. The fact of the matter is that the Constitution gives no specific requirement, however, to maintain the health of the body politic. It doesn't say, and you have the right to insurance or you have the right to particular levels of health care. It leaves this to the judgment of the people. And the argument I just made that the constitutional language should have informed the people to prefer health over, say, expenditures on roads. And I should say, people in Malta often ask me the question you've impliedly asked, Father, you know, how is it the United States doesn't have health care? And I would typically quip, well, we chose roads and you chose health care.
Is that a criticism of our roads?
there might be a pothole or two out there. But it's also criticism, Professor, of the choice, that as important as it is to have a fine, up-to-date transportation system, if in fact there's no opportunity to maintain one's health as a primary matter, you're not out driving, you're not out pursuing other things that roads are necessary for. So I think President Obama tried to use the legislative process and successfully accomplished mm-hmm. using the legislative process to convince people that they should tax themselves to provide for those who can't provide for themselves, the severely disabled, those who are the long-term unemployed, the individuals who, in fact, can't go into the insurance market and buy very expensive insurance policies. But that was a legislative choice. It was a legislative choice that I think is greatly supported by the language of the Constitution, but it's not mandated by the Constitution. It's an inference from it rather than a requirement.
But isn't opposition to this health scheme also partly because of the cultural framework in the United States, that each individual should actually strive on his own to improve his own position, you know, money-wise, health-wise, whatever, and be as little dependent on government as possible?
Well, this is, again, an old argument about does the Constitution guarantee a set of positive rights, or is it merely a negative protection? There are many political voices as well as judicial voices in the United States that would say the Constitution protects us against government encroachment, but it doesn't protect us from, or it doesn't entitle us or give us a set of positive rights to education, shelter, health. I think it's true, quite frankly, that the original structure of the American Constitution left it up to us to make those policy choices that would foster health, education, and shelter. But in leaving it up to us in our freedom, it also left the possibility that we would not choose health, that we would not choose education, that we would not choose shelter. And therefore, it's not a positive grant of those things in the Constitution. It's merely a grant of freedom to allow us to make good choices, but it also allows us to make bad choices. So the president didn't just declare that there was health care now available for 32 million people. He had to go convince his fellow citizens to make that choice. But if he failed in that persuasion, we're basically back to the question of, is that freedom well used or ill used? If now the Republicans, who have gained control of the House, for example, manage to take apart the president's health care plan, bit by bit, piece by piece, and let's say a majority of the Republic approves of that deconstruction of the health care plan, is that a good use of freedom or a poor use of freedom? I would argue that it's an ill-considered use of freedom, that it's a failure to recognize the needs of others and the need to be in service of others, the need to pursue the common good and not just the individual good. But that's the argument I have to prevail with as a matter of persuasion, as opposed to pointing to anything in the Constitution that mandates that outcome.
An argument which has already been mentioned in connection with freedom in the United States has been the connection between freedom and wealth. It was mentioned in the context of the media. But I think it can also crop up in another argument, which is not the media itself, but rather the grouping of influence that you have when it comes to central issues which affect the individual but also affect the interests of particular corporations. Let's give an easy example. We know the long struggle that took place in the United States to establish beyond doubt the harmful effects of smoking. And because the tobacco companies had a bottomless wallet, both on the political side and also on the legal side, they could drag this out on and on and on. How is freedom affected in that respect?
Well, you're absolutely right that the tobacco companies are quite wealthy, and it has been historically an important industry in the country. I think the science is unequivocal, mm-hmm. that it causes cancer and it has other negative health effects.
And if I can butt in, I've just been listening to the BBC where they have given the results of surveys that have been done and saying, concluding that secondary smoking, passive smoking, is more dangerous than smoking itself.
And I've seen those reports as well, Father, and that makes the question nicely complicated. Because one claim would be, and certainly you would hear this libertarian claim in the United States, I have the right to choose my poison. Mm-hmm. I have the right, if I want to use alcohol, to use alcohol. I have the right to smoke if I want to smoke. You even saw that argument play out in California in terms of access to mm-hmm. marijuana, where the legalization of marijuana was on the ballot. It got defeated in the most recent midterm election, but it was there. People making the argument that they have the right to use their freedom even when it harms themselves. And then when Father Borges adds the complication of you're not just harming yourself, but you're mm-hmm. harming others, what does that do? When you impose your external, the harm that you've taken onto yourself, on others, it makes it clearer that you don't have no right to do that, right? That then calls out for government to exercise its power to protect life. Mm-hmm. And whether the tobacco company is wealthy or not, when you have a government entity like the Food and Drug Administration that presumably is supposed to protect us from adulterated foods or other substances, that arguably tobacco would be within that that category, especially when the harm is imposed on others. One can also argue, however, that do we really have the right to harm ourselves?
Mm-hmm.
You know, from a natural law perspective, the answer, I think, would be unequivocally no. And indeed from the natural law that was incorporated in the Declaration of Independence recites life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness not just as ordinary rights, but as unalienable rights. And they're unalienable, meaning that not only can someone force you to give it up,
but you can't give it up yourself.
You can't give it up yourself. Mm-hmm. And when the positive law moves away from that natural law base, it starts to get confused. And when it gets confused, the effect is that positive laws in the name of freedom, quote-unquote, get enacted or permitted, that practices are permitted that the natural law would not allow. So I would argue when you have a statute that confers power on an administrative agency to regulate adulterated foods, and then you have an ambiguity in the statute as to whether or not it was intended to cover tobacco or not cover tobacco, that you would resolve that ambiguity in favor of the one that is more consistent with human nature, mm-hmm. and more consistent with the natural law, in favor of allowing the agency to reach that product and exclude it from the market. I seem to be picking on the Supreme Court a lot today because the Supreme Court of the United States decided exactly the other way and in a very narrowly drawn, I think it was 5-4 opinion, decided that the FDA's authority didn't reach tobacco, which means that it continues to be marketed relatively freely in the United States, and of course we know it's exported around the world as well. I will say I think the United States as a legislative matter has conveyed this harm about secondary smoke very increasingly well, and so one finds a good number of American communities where it's not only is it not possible to smoke in public buildings, but sometimes in entire towns. And so you have to put your cigarette out as you cross mm-hmm. the municipal boundary.
Infatti, li sem jeta, etti sem ol programu xkelma bejtnejn, l-intervista tal-BOV, jien Fader Joe Borsch, l-mkiem ma' Joe, pero tett intervista u l-ambasġadur Amerikan, il-professur Douglas Kemmick. Pamana, inkomplu wara din il-pawsa qasira.
Tkun xi tkun it-triq li tagħżel matul high-tech, aħna nistgħu ngħinuk tfassal pjan finanzjarju li jaqdi l-ħtiġijiet tiegħek. Kellimna issa Bank of Valletta. Impenn lejn is-suċċess tiegħek. Il-Bank of Valletta huwa licenzjat sabiex jipprovdi servizzi ta' investiment mill-MFSA.
Ambassador, one of the elements about the United States, which many people in Malta find difficult to understand, is how the Supreme Court, which has so much power, and under the American Constitution rightly so, actually gets put together. And I use that word on purpose, that phrase on purpose. Because one of the debates we very often hear that go on in America when it comes to choosing judges is about a president wanting to increase the liberals on the Supreme Court, another president wants to increase the conservatives, and so on. How would you explain this difficult situation where we're used to appointing judges without this kind of scrutiny, if you like, of political leanings? Political leaning, not partisan leanings, I'm talking political philosophy leanings.
Well, I think every president, and this is why presidential elections are so important. Every president has a philosophy of government. Every president has a philosophy of government that includes how they would see that philosophy implemented through interpretation of the Constitution by people they would appoint to the Supreme Court. The two main philosophies that have been contending have been philosophies of judicial restraint, one that would say judges should interpret the Constitution very, very strictly, very literally in terms of its meaning as it existed in 1789 when most of it was ratified, or at a later date when some of the amendments were ratified, versus a point of view that says, no, yes, you need to be informed by what the original meaning was, but you also have to take an assessment of the present-day consequences.
The world has changed.
And so that if at the time of the founding the death penalty was commonplace because the prison system was inadequate, or because we just simply were not well informed about the culpability of various levels of people, you know, the handicapped and the mentally retarded or the youthful offender. But if in modern life you would question the culpability of someone who is mentally handicapped, or question the culpability of someone of a particular youth, or maybe question the death penalty altogether because the prison system is more than adequate to address the safety of the community, then you ought to take that into account when you determine whether or not the death penalty is available for a particular crime. So those are the two contending positions. One side says, since the death penalty was available in 1789, it shall always be available. The other side says, well, the death penalty might be appropriate if the community was indeed threatened at its core, but not otherwise. And different presidents find themselves on different points of that spectrum, and then they look to replicate their particular point of view in the people they nominate to the Supreme Court. Now, people get appointed to the Supreme Court by the president's nomination and then with the Senate's confirmation. So there are two branches of government involved, but once they're appointed, they serve for life, and that's an important means by which their objectivity and independence is guaranteed. But it also means that they might not stay with the philosophy that they advertise themselves as having when, and they might well have had when the president appointed them, but because of the growth of their own intellectual endeavors, might take them in a different direction. So, and not infrequently, presidents have expressed the view that some of the largest mistakes they made were the people they put on the Supreme Court, and you see both Democratic and Republican presidents expressing this.
How often does the Supreme Court reverse itself on particular key issues?
Very seldom. Which is why that if they make a pronouncement and they anchor it in the Constitution as their understanding of what the Constitution requires, there are very few major cases of the court reversing itself. It happens. It happened in the area of race, for example. But it's a long struggle. Often, in the context of race, it was 50, 60 years or more. So it is often better if the court can rule on statutory grounds, because then if they get the statute wrong, or if Congress thinks they've misinterpreted the policy, Congress can, through a new law, basically override the Supreme Court.
Yep. But there are people in the United States, many people in the United States, who believe that the right to freedom includes the right to decide whether someone else exists or not, lives or not, abortion.
Right.
So they have, my freedom includes the right to end your life. What kind of freedom is this?
Well, this is a question that I suspect you and I agree, Father, is a usurpation on the part of the court to, first of all, speak to this topic, and then certainly speak to it in the way that they have addressed it. This is another example of where, when the court infers something into the text of the Constitution, in this case a right to take another life, and they declare it to be so, they declare it to be the autonomy of the woman to make that choice, it makes it very difficult for the political process to to moderate that, or to have any choice that would be in the opposite direction and more honoring of life as one would see it in from the Catholic perspective in particular. So the one of the things that I thought was quite helpful in the 2008 election was that President Obama, views the abortion question differently than I do, views it accepts it as a matter of individual choice, but wants to convey the point of view that it's a tragic choice, and he wants to address the circumstances which give rise to that tragic choice.
Like poverty,
like ignorance, like lack of maternal health care, and so forth. And so while I would be of the view that the court had no power to declare this right, the president shares the view that the court did have that power, but both of us would agree that whether you thought this an appropriate constitutional question or not, there are means by which you can reduce the incidence of abortion by addressing the mean circumstances in which women who make that choice and who often then regret it because of the consequences mm-hmm. of it. But that's where we are in the United States on that issue. And it's another example, as you say, of freedom. One would argue that when you declare life to be an inalienable right, you can't take it yourself, and you certainly can't take the life of someone else. Now, of course, you know where the argument then goes. The argument goes, what is life? When does life begin? Mm-hmm. And you have plenty of scientific disagreement on that question in terms of the significance of the embryo. And unless this program is several days long as opposed to the amount of time it is, I probably shouldn't pick that one up.
In fact, we are in our last 3 minutes, but my comment that I wanted to make is that I think at the end of the day it's a kind of an anthropological question, in the sense how do we view the human person? Because at one point you were saying, people say, I am free to do anything I want so long as I do not harm others. But given the fact, at least from my perspective, that our lives are so tied together, interwoven together, there are very, very few things, if there are, which I can do, which have an effect on me, but do not have an effect on others. So even choosing the poison I want, harming myself, will include harming others.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. We are an interdependent world, and the question that you started with is still the right question. Mm-hmm. How does one know the truth of where freedom ends and license begins? Mm-hmm. That's really what we've been asking ourselves. Mm-hmm. The Constitution of the United States doesn't pretend to have the answer to that question. Instead, it creates a democratic process by which men and women can reason together to try and place that line appropriately in the legislative process. And that's why one of the most important freedoms in the Constitution is the freedom of religion, because when you think about what are the sources of knowledge? Sources of knowledge are the natural law, those things that we can know ourselves just simply by self-evident truth, but it's also those things that are given to us in revealed faith. Faith only matters if it's a freely given, uncoerced faith, and one of the most important features of the Constitution of the United States, it says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise of religion. So by virtue of that, it opens the door to a source of knowledge that is beyond man. Many of us believe that without that source of knowledge, we're just totally lost in this place, this exile. And I can tell you, after my summer experience, without faith, I would be totally lost on the meaning of what it is that I'm about here and what my purpose is for. And so I'm grateful to be both in this place as well as in the United States, where the ability to pursue faith freely is sanctioned and approved.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador.
Thank you.
Dak il-ambasġatur Amerikan, il-Professur Douglas Kamik, jitkellem miegħi fadal Joe Borċu mal-ħabibti il-Professur Joe Pirotta, li ringrazzjawkom tal-attenzjoni tagħkom waqt nagħmlu appuntament magħkom għal-bħal lum ġimgħa. Saħħa.
Għadkom kemm smajtu. Mhux kelma bejtnej, l-intervista tal-Bank of Valletta. Produzzjoni u preżentazzjoni ta' Father Joe Borċ u l-Professur Joe Pirotta.